welcome back to the Crash MotoGP podcast. And the first race weekend of the season is now complete, and we're here to talk about it. I'm Jordan Morland, and I'll be joined by Pete McLaren and Rob Jones. Guys, how are we? That was a pretty interesting weekend for MotoGP.
It was, wasn't it, Jordan? Yes, it, you know, coming into the new season, you never quite know what's going to happen. Everybody had made their predictions, not just us. I think all the fans watching would have as well. When you look at the results, you see Peckham at the top again, don't you? But certainly some, well, quite a lot of twists and turns along the way, weren't there?
Yeah, definitely. And Rob, what are your thoughts on the weekend? It's pretty much what you expected, or?
Yeah, I think obviously the major names were at the front, but I don't think that took away at all from the racing. I think both races were really interesting. Obviously, the Grand Prix, the longer format, you know, it brings tire degradation into things, and the riders have to, I guess, strategize a bit more. But both races were very, very good, and there was certainly some standout performances.
Yeah, we'll touch on the Grand Prix in a moment. We'll first talk about the sprint race that we seen on Saturday. We should have really predicted that Jorge Martin, you know, he is the sprint king. 10 sprint race wins now over 2022 and into 2023 into 2024. Yeah, Pete, it was pretty much domination from him in the sprint.
Yeah, as you say, I think it was, well, he won it also, didn't he, last November at Qatar. So he certainly knows how to win round there in a short race. I think the surprise was actually Pecco not being up there, wasn't it? It was that, I think that caught a lot of people off guard. And it was a slow weekend up to, right, really, the race, wasn't it, on Sunday for Pecco. They were sort of slow in practice. It looked like almost like a weekend from last year where he took time to get comfortable on the bike, wasn't happy with the sprint, qualifying second row, and all those things. And in the meantime, you've got Brad Binder and Aleix Espargaró, two other brands up there fighting at the front of the sprint.
And Rob, we touched off camera about, you know, the expectation after the sprint. You know, as Pete says, Binder and Espargaró, you know, two non-Ducatis, you know, they were looking very strong for KTM and Aprilia. Do you think Binder's performance wasn't really a surprise? We talked about it last week. But with Espargaró, you know, we had a good pre-season, and it looked like from the sprint, if the pace would correlate across to the Grand Prix, he would be the one at the end that would really benefit. But what did you think of Aprilia's pace in the sprint particularly?
Well, like you said,
cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In preseason testing, especially in Qatar, Aprilia were very, very fast, especially with Raul Fernandez and Espargaró. And obviously they sort of had the pace on Friday. And then going into the sprint, I think we all knew that Espargaró could put one lap together in qualifying, which he did. And then he showed and sort of backed up what we were thinking, that he could be the main challenger to Ducati. Obviously, Binder was ahead of him in the sprint. But the late race pace Espargaró had is what I think had me the most excited going into the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Because he sort of built as the race went on and was clearly the fastest rider on track at the end of the sprint. So I think going into the Grand Prix, we all had the expectation that Binder would be there, because Binder's always there come Sunday. And the KTM is obviously very close to the Ducati in terms of performance. Espargaró being a bit more of a wild card, I guess, going into the first round. But then when we saw his sprint performance, I think it was almost nailed on in the Grand Prix that he was going to, if he could get a good start, at least he'd be there. And obviously he didn't get a great start, lost a few positions in the first two laps. But I think he'll be more disappointed than anyone with the sprint performance going into the Sunday, and how it went the other way and it was roles reversed. Yeah.
And as Pete, as you said, Bagnaia in fourth. It wasn't really a standout ride. It was kind of, he just looked like he was, how could you put it, working with what he had, essentially. You know, it wasn't like Martin, who was able just to get the hammer down straight away and go. But then, you know, for Bagnaia to have a GP23 behind him and it being Marc Márquez, you know, and Márquez was catching him at the end of that sprint, it seemed to be a mentality switch for Bagnaia going into Sunday warm-up. He said after the Grand Prix yesterday that they worked on something on Saturday and they tested it out in warm-up, and it seemed to be the thing that transformed his race, essentially, for yesterday. Do you think that, you know, last year it was very much always, Pecco was always playing catch-up. His worst result was a fourth and a first this weekend. It's a pretty strong start for the world champion.
It is, and it was quite a turnaround, as you say, Jordan, on the Sunday, wasn't it? To go from where he was in the sprint, where people were going, oh, maybe he's in trouble here, to really controlling the Grand Prix. And it just showed Pecco's class, I think, especially that strategy of attacking on that opening lap, when everyone knew you had to be careful with the tyres, and yet he goes on the attack to get to the front, knowing that he can then manage it. And, you know, Martin pretty switched on. He saw what Pecco was trying to do, and he tried to get hold of him, didn't he? But Pecco just kept him out of reach all the time. And yeah, it just shows the extra capacity that the champions have. And yeah, I thought that was impressive.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to write off Bagnaia. I think because, you know, he's not the most, how can you say, people just kind of see when he gets a bit frustrated, he comes into the box, he gets a bit agitated, he throws the hands a bit, but I think his mentality, and as you say, when it comes to a Grand Prix, there's just a switch with him. And I think, you know, he shows why he's a double world champion. And he looked incredible yesterday. It was really impressive to see. As you say, lap one, he took the lead straight away and no one got near him. I mean, Brad Binder said, you know, he made one mistake, and it wasn't even really a mistake. He ran wide by about a metre at one corner he's seen, and that was it. But other than that, it was pretty much flawless from Bagnaia. And, you know, the best way to start his, you know, title defence, he's won now first opening races for both his title years. So defending his title, he came in and he's won last year in Portimao, and now he's won the Grand Prix again in Qatar. But when you look at Brad Binder for the Grand Prix, I think I shared a graphic yesterday on social media. It went Ducati first, KTM second, and the rest of the top seven was all Ducatis. Brad Binder is doing incredible things on that KTM. And we'll come on to Pedro Acosta, who was just sensational, but of course that lack of experience. Rob Binder, I think he's doing incredible things and he's showing how good he can be on that KTM. What did you make of his performance in the Grand Prix?
I think obviously Acosta stole some of the limelight, but I think Binder's performances in both races, but especially the Grand Prix, was amazing. I mean, he's clearly, and he's been doing it for 2-3 years now, he's been getting the best out of that bike when other riders aren't. And that's not to say the bike isn't good, because it's clearly right up there and able to challenge. But I think Binder's ability, I mean, you said it yourself with Bagnaia when it comes to the Grand Prix, how he's just able to make that extra step that other riders don't seem to be able to do. And I think Binder's in that category. If he could just have a bike, because obviously he mentioned after the sprint that it was just edge grip that they're struggling with.
Yeah,
coming out of the corners, picking up the bike and getting power to the rear tire, Ducati are just a little bit ahead of them from that perspective. But if KTM can sort that out, I think Binder will be winning races and contending for the title. It's just a matter of, can they do it soon enough? Because we saw, and to your point, Martin had a bit more pace late on. But even when Binder is starting to struggle, it's one thing him struggling, it's another thing to get past him. Yeah. And he's also very good in his defense. So I think he's the complete package. And I think he showed that again yesterday.
Pete, you touched on it on the last podcast. You said, you know, KTM, you know, they're here to win, essentially. They don't want to be finishing third, second, but a very strong weekend. You know, Brad Binder, he's 2 second places. And, you know, where do you think that puts them going into tracks, you know, the European circuits that we're going to go to after, you know, Texas? Do you think it sets them up well for that run of the season?
I think if you look at the sprint race times last year, this year, KTM, I think it was something like 17 seconds faster. I mean, they made the biggest step of anybody. I think then it was Aprilia, then Ducati, and the Japanese brands were sort of further back. So, I mean, that shows. They didn't have a great race, did they, in November? I think Binder had front tyre issues or something.
He did, yeah.
Nothing like that this time around, was there? So, you know, to the point being, perform like that at a track that's not one of their best. That's the thing, isn't it? This isn't a KTM track, and to make that size of a step, yeah, it certainly bodes well for the rest of the year. And as you say, you know, you've got guys like Acosta pushing another fast guy in there, more data, you know, to look at if you're Brad Binder, to see maybe where you can improve as well. It's only going to push the whole project forward.
And as you mentioned, Pedro Acosta, I mean, social media was absolutely lighting up when he was making his charge for the pack. It was great to see. It was a bit reminiscent of when Marc Marquez and Valentino Rossi had that. They battled at Qatar in 2013, you know, the rookie coming in against, you know, the star of MotoGP. And we've seen that with Pedro Acosta and Marc Marquez. You know, Acosta ran as high as fourth, you know, when he overtook Marquez in the turn one. I couldn't quite believe it. I was like, oh my God, like, this is a generational sort of thing we're seeing here. And yeah, as you said, you know, that bit of experience, the tires did drop off in the end and he did finish ninth. But I've read his quotes after the race and he said that he lived the dream essentially for 15 laps. And Rob, we talked about, you know, we had a great preseason for a rookie and it was so exciting to see, you know, someone like this come up into the class and just, it's a bit different, but his weekend was, I thought, was pretty great, to be fair.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was everything that I think we hoped for. And what was interesting is his performance is almost what I expected in the sprint, is for him to go as fast as he could for 11 laps and just give the guys in front as much trouble as he could. He had a good sprint, but then obviously going into the Grand Prix, and he, like, to your point about what he said post-race, he sort of was happy to just sacrifice potential performance at the end to just be in the battle, learn from them, and then wherever he finished is where he finished. But the way he was comfortable battling with those guys at the front, considering it's the first time he's done that, there's nothing about him that looks like a rookie at the moment. Obviously, the tire wear at the end is something that he'll build into, and after, you know, maybe another two or three rounds, I think he'll sort out. But when he got past, I think it was Alex Marquez, and was behind Marc Marquez, it was almost a case of, right, he's now behind the top four, and those were the top four that everyone sort of anticipated. Was he going to sit there, or was he just going to continue to push? And he sat there for a couple of laps, and it almost looked to me like fifth was going to be the best he could achieve. And then he went past Mark at turn one. And that's the point where I was like, how far could he go, basically? And because he was right behind Martin until the tire dropped. And then he went wide off track and Mark got back ahead. And then the drop sort of started. But his performance overall, I don't think we've seen a better one from a rookie for a long time.
Yeah, and I completely agree, Rob. And as you said, he doesn't look like a rookie. I mean, his overtakes were clean. How he was able to carry the speed into turn one. Like, he was outbreaking Marc Marquez, and we know how strong those Ducatis are in the brakes. And he was it was incredible. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it was such a breath of fresh air, I think. You know, MotoGP has waited on that generational talent. You know, we have Bagnaia, Martin, we've had Joan Mir win, but it feels different. I don't know what it is. It just feels like, you know, he's came along. He's been so successful from a young age in the lower classes, and he's just came in and essentially arrived. And I'd love to have known Marc Marquez's reaction when he's seen just Acosta go up the end and said he must have just maybe had a little smile and thought, yeah, I've been there as well. I know what that's like. What do you think for Acosta, his target will be going into the next Grand Prix? Obviously, he did have testing time around Qatar, so he got used to the track a lot more than he would say for Portimao. But do you think his expectation, and he seems pretty grounded on it, that he'll just keep building and delivering like he's been doing?
Yeah, he's absolutely refusing to give any specific expectations, is he? Everyone's trying, you know, what are you expecting? And he's, and it's quite a clever tactic. He's just completely refusing to say any kind of numbers or expectations. He's saying expectation counts for nothing. You know, it's just about what you do on the track. And I think it's a good approach, isn't it? But you've got to believe that he's going to want to keep stepping up. So this is the starting point, and he'll be looking to do at least the same, if not better, in Portimao. That would be what you would expect from him. Also, because that's what he's done so far, isn't it? He's learned every time he's got on the bike. He's gone quicker. He's gone up the timesheets kind of thing. So he'll be looking to continue that. But as you say, Jordan, not as easy at Portimao because you haven't got the test. So it'll be a big question mark, not just for Acosta, but also for people like Mark, to see how quickly they can get up to speed on a track without any testing. And as you say, Acosta just looked like he was having the time of his life. life out there, didn't he? He could have, you know, probably if he'd done the nice, safe, boring tyre conservation race, maybe he would have finished seventh, you know, two places higher. But, you know, the amount that he learnt, and I think Marquez said this, by fighting with those riders is worth way more than one or two positions at the end of the race. And that's what people remember. And it'll fire him up, it'll fire the whole team up, won't it? So, yeah, a great debut. And I think, yeah, everyone will be looking forward to see what he does at the next races.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think Hervé Poncharal can't believe his luck. He's literally got just an absolute gem in his team, and it's only going to make them better. And as you mentioned about adaptation, Marc Marquez this weekend. Now, I said last week, I asked you a question, if he finished inside the top five and maybe got a podium, that would be a good weekend. He got a fifth place in the sprint and a fourth in the Grand Prix. Overall, I'd say that was a very good weekend for him.
Yeah, exactly. So far, so good, wasn't it, really? He didn't look like he was overstretching himself. That was the thing, wasn't it? Everything was under control. None of the... I mean, what a contrast to a year ago at the Portimao season opener, where he's sort of wrestling with the Honda and clashing with Oliveira and everything else. Just looked like he had everything completely in control. Not completely comfortable, but still in control on the bike. And just, I think it showed that what we saw in testing was realistic, wasn't it? Everyone wasn't sure, is he sandbagging? Is he holding back? But really, what he was telling us, it looks like that's where he is. He said, look, I'm about, you know, top four or five. There's a few guys quicker than me, mainly Martin and Bagnaia, obviously the guys on the Ducati that he's looking at to learn from. And that was the case. So actually, I think it's, you know, I think it went as well as it could have done realistically. You know, miracles don't often happen, do they, in MotoGP? Okay, you got Rossi in 2004 winning on the Yamaha, Stoner 2007 on the Ducati, but you know, he couldn't go in wishing for a miracle. And you know, he delivered the best that he could do, and it's where he needs to be. Especially, I think, if he looks back at where the Hondas are, also he's going to think, yeah, I've made the right move here. And it's a great starting point. And a bit like Acosta, he's now going to be looking to go up from here. And I mean, to be already, as you say, John, on the edge of the podium, well, this is what he wants, isn't it? This is what he said he needs when he made the move. He wants to be up the front, fighting in contention again. And he's there right from his first race on the Gresini. So.
Yeah, and he kept mentioning, you know, I think it was on Thursday, and he said on Friday after that he had this mentality of, you know, he felt like he was riding the Honda. He had to get that out of his system. And, you know, once he reset that, it's the first weekend I can ever remember watching Marc Marquez be... He was competitive, but it didn't look like he was stressed at all. Like, his riding position looked so different when he was on a fast lap, especially in qualifying. You know, it just looked like effortless compared to what it used to be with the Honda. You know, it was shaking everywhere. The front end was talking. He was fighting with it. And it's a completely different Marc Marquez we're seeing, I think, mentality-wise. You know, he isn't using all his energy into one race. He's thinking about down the season, you know, when I get comfortable, I'll be okay. And I think this weekend validated that even more. And Rob, when you look at the sprint race, I predicted him, I thought he was going to win the sprint, but he didn't get the best of starts in the sprint. And that seemed to have hampered what his expectations would have been. You know, I think he maybe could have thought he fought for a podium in the sprint if it wasn't for the bad start. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think for me, a podium was going to be sort of the best he could do in the sprint, or like a likely result if he'd got a good start. Obviously, to your point, he didn't get a good start, and then he spent the first lap and a half in a really intense battle with Di Giannantonio. They were exchanging positions at every corner, it felt like. So I think Mark was then having to almost an act of recovery and just try and get back to his grid position. And then once he did, he had obviously the two factory Ducatis in front of him, got past Bastianini. But I think it was just once he'd got back to that position, obviously Martin was leading, Binder and Bagnaia were all ahead of him. And they were sort of comfortable with their pace, and the pace was a bit too hot to then start making sort of a challenge forward.
Yeah.
But his performance overall, I agree with you guys, I think was brilliant. And I think he'll be very, very happy with it. And in the Grand Prix, I think we've got to remember the three guys who were ahead of him are all on factory bikes, and they're arguably the three riders that we thought were going to be top three in the championship this year. And he was still only 3 seconds off the win. So it was a great weekend.
And as you mentioned about the Grand Prix, you know, the top three, at one point, it looked like with a few laps to go, he was closing down Jorge Martin, especially in the third and fourth sector. And he got the around 2-3 temps, and he could just sniff the podium. But I think Martin maybe got a message or looked at his board as he went past and went, no. He could see that Binder was maybe struggling, and he went, I'm going here because I'm not getting involved in a battle with Marquez. And you could see that Marquez, once he seen Martin go, he was like, no, it's not worth chasing down. And it's a really different approach. You know, Mark Marquez, you've seen the picture of him on Saturday when he finished fifth. After, when he came into the box, he was so happy with a P5. I can't remember him ever smiling like that, ever, from when he, you know, apart from the test that we've seen in Valencia, where he had the smile after riding the Ducati. It clearly, it shows that he made the right decision. And as you said, Pete, you know, looking at the other Honda and you'd say the Japanese bikes, they're nowhere compared. They're in a different race compared to where he is. We'll talk about Honda. I think they've looked better than Yamaha, Pete, this weekend. I think Mir and Zarco had a fairly strong race. You know, Quartararo, yes, was the highest Japanese bike. Yeah, what's your thoughts on Yamaha and Honda, especially this weekend?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a reality check, wasn't it? I think they did just show the work that's still ahead of them. And that there is this clear gap between the Europeans and I think as Quartararo called it, the Japanese Cup. You know, that's what those guys were fighting for, really, wasn't it? And very close, as you say, between Quartararo, Mir and Zarco for that top Japanese bike, if you like. But I think, yeah, it was the Honda guys that felt more optimistic afterwards, felt that they'd taken more of a step. I mean, Mir was massively faster compared to last November, personally. Yep. Okay, if you look at the top Honda, obviously Mark was on the Honda then, so it's not quite as a clear comparison. But for him personally, he took a big step. And he was, yeah, he said, you know, it wasn't a disaster. I mean, he messed up the end of the Grand Prix because he just pushed too hard. He went too hard too early to try and pass Quartararo, and he had nothing left in the tyres and lost the time, and that was why. But yeah, you know, he felt he was there. They made progress. As you say, for Yamaha, on the other hand, there really wasn't much to be positive about, was there? I think Quartararo said we're as far, if not further away than ever. And they certainly made on paper the smallest step. Obviously, the Grand Prix was a lap shorter, so that's not so easy to compare directly. But the sprint race times, I mean, it was, I think, only about 5 seconds faster than last November. So, yeah, I think, you know, if you're Quartararo in this crucial time of the season with thinking about next year and contracts, you know, he's going to want to see some big progress, isn't he, in these next few races?
Definitely. And Rob, it was, like we said last week, it was the qualifying that was the issue. You know, once he was already in Q1, it didn't really look like he was going to get out of it because there was so many, you know, there were strong bikes in that Q1 session as well. And, you know, the positivity for Honda was that Johann Zarco was very close to getting into Q2. But for Yamaha, it's a completely different story.
Yeah, for Yamaha, we sort of touched on it last week. We were quite worried about where they were. And obviously with the schedule change going into Sasse and that final practice meaning a lot going into qualifying, I was keeping like a close eye on where Quartararo was in that session. And he spent nearly all the session in P17, P18, just positions that we're not used to seeing him in, and the Yamaha. But it's a very disappointing first round because Qatar's always been a good track for Yamaha as well with the corner speed. And like you said, Pete, with the contract situation the way that it is, Yamaha have almost gone into their most crucial season because without Quartararo, they've already shown that the bike's not where it needs to be. And with Quartararo, they're not achieving any results really. And without Quartararo, they're going to be completely lost. So when it's come to the most crucial point of needing to retain him and at least show him we've got a bike that can, you know, achieve good results, or we've got a direction that's going to allow for that, they've almost given him the worst possible scenario for the rider that they need the most. And it's a very, very worrying time. But for Honda, I thought Zarco was very fast all weekend. I was impressed with Zarco. I think we all sort of had this hope that he would go into Honda. Obviously, he got that 2-year deal and he's got time to work and try and improve the project. And I think that was already sort of in show in Qatar. And I think him and Mir both had a strong race. Obviously, Mir had the tyre issues later on and Zarco was able to finish top Honda. But I think, like you said, Pete, they'll be much, much more content going forward. Whereas Yamaha, they just seem completely lost and I don't know where they go from here.
And then looking at Luca Marini, for example. Now,
a lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's a bit of an unwanted stat. You know, he held pole position at Qatar in November on the Ducati, and he finished both the sprint and the Grand Prix dead last. And when you think about that transition to Honda, it will be difficult for him, but Pete, he obviously struggled the most out of all of these Japanese riders and bikes. Sorry, he was 42 seconds off the win for the Grand Prix. It's a lot of building steps for him to get comfortable on that bike.
Yeah, it definitely looks like it, doesn't it? Yeah, I think as you mentioned, there was the rainstorm, wasn't there, on the Friday night and everything else, which probably reduced the grip further. And those guys are already struggling for rear grip, aren't they? And Marini in particular, he just can't turn the bike quick enough in the middle of the corner, it seems, is what he's saying. So, yeah, I mean, Marini, he's a guy who controls his emotions. You know, he's realistic, I think was the word he uses. You know, he knows where they're starting from. But yeah, he definitely, you don't want to obviously start your career with a new team at the back of the grid. And unfortunately, that's what happened. So on the plus side, he's got the data of those guys ahead of him, the guys you've been talking about, Mir and Zarco, to look at on exactly the same bike. All the four Hondas are the same. So he can see where they're gaining on him. But yeah, I think it was, you know, he wouldn't have been expecting that weekend. Everyone knew it wasn't going to be an instant turnaround, of course.
Yeah.
But they weren't expecting, I don't think, especially Marini, to be that hard. And yeah, he'd be disappointed to see those other bikes ahead of him. That's the thing, isn't it? If you're Quartararo, you can say, well, look, I'm the top guy on the Yamaha by quite a way, wasn't he, from Rins? I think Rins 16th. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, you know, Marini's got a couple of guys ahead of him. So yeah, work to do there.
Definitely. And Rob, talking about new teams, Trackhouse Aprilia, they had a bit of an up and down weekend. Looked very good with Raul Fernandez from qualifying. He showed very good pace, and yeah, the sprint that really didn't go to plan. He dropped off and he was 14th, and then obviously yesterday the aborted start because the issue he had with his bike, we believe it was an error code on the dash, and then he had to start from the back of the grid. Miguel Oliveira had a penalty carry across from last season to this, so his Grand Prix was pretty much kind of ruined at the start. You know, he couldn't really progress. He ended up finishing with 1 point, you know, 15th. A difficult, but it showed some promise for Trackhouse this weekend.
Yeah, there was promise for the team to take away for sure. And I think from their perspective, it would have been overall a good round in the sense that they've got two riders who can be very fast, and they showed that at times. It's just for Raul Fernandez, we sort of need to see that potential going into the races and him sort of act upon that and be able to, because his performance in Q1 was very, very good. And then, but immediately in Q2, he was last and it just sort of, it tailed off within the space of a few minutes. He wasn't able to build on that. Then obviously the sprint, like you said, he sort of dropped off in the race. I was expecting a bit more from Oliveira. I know he had a tough preseason, but it seemed like, again, he was just moving forward and going on an upwards trajectory in the weekend. And obviously Fernando's had the issue at the start, and then there was a lot of confusion in pit lane, a lot of emotions going on, running back to the garage for the second bike, and then he pulled in towards the end of the race. So overall, disappointing result, but I think there was enough potential to show that they can be competitive, and obviously they've got the machinery to be fast.
It wasn't really the best weekend for Aprilia, Pete, overall. When you see the results, you know, it showed on paper really for Friday and Saturday, you know, potential was there for them, but it's kind of, I wouldn't say the same old story. They just kind of have these weekends where they don't really deliver, and the bike doesn't sit in the window between sessions sometimes, and it just, Maverick Viñales looked, I mean, judging by body language, he was doing interviews and stuff with Susie Perry before the race, and he didn't really look happy. He had the sunglasses on, wasn't really chatting that much. There wasn't really any, I couldn't really sense of a great vibe from him. And he was just kind of in no man's land for the sprint and the Grand Prix. He finished, let me see, yeah, he was 10th place in the Grand Prix, and he was 13 seconds off the race win, but there was someone 4 seconds behind him, so he was just, yeah, no man's land really for Viñales.
Yeah, you're right there, Jordan. I mean, it just carried in from the testing, didn't it, really, where it's been Aleix, isn't it, who's been the guy putting the Aprilia up there, but as we saw in the Grand Prix, if he has an issue, the other guys are nowhere near him, and he sort of dropped back, didn't he, to where they were. Interesting, isn't it? I just think it's great. You've got Aleix, the oldest school riding style on the grid, and it's matching with the most, you know, technically, aerodynamically advanced bike, and it's working, isn't it? And yet you've got the guys like Viñales and Oliveira who have the elbow down, the modern style, and for whatever reason, at the moment, they're not able to match Aleix. And I just think that's great that the old school style. I mean, it's obviously not as simple as that, but maybe it's something to do with the way he sits on the bike in the corners. It doesn't interrupt the airflow around the aero on the bike, and that's what's working for him. Who knows? But whatever it is, as you say, there's a clear gap between him and the other guys on the Aprilia, and that's a massive frustration for Viñales, because he finished last year believing, yeah, I've got the bike exactly how I want it. It's consistent. You know, we finally got over these consistency issues that you were flagging up there, Jordan. And then the new bike comes along, everything's changed, and he's nowhere near comfortable on it again. And Oliveira seems to be a similar thing to Viñales, doesn't it? They're sort of in that same sort of position. And then you've got Raul on the year-old bike, who's, as you say, was quick, very quick in some sessions, also warm-up, I think he was quick. But yet, yeah, it just all goes wrong in the race, doesn't it? And he retired, didn't he? Because the spare bike he went on to had used tyres on it. So, of course, I mean, they were already struggling to go the distance. So you put the used tyres on and you've got no chance. So that was him done and dusted. So, yeah, character building would probably be the phrase for the Trackhouse team in their first Grand Prix. But yeah, you know, there's potential there. But certainly, yeah, I think Aprilia will feel like... I mean, Aleix was trying to sort of look at it a bit on the bright side and say, look, this is one of the best starts I've made, maybe the best start to a Grand Prix season. He's I think, what, sixth in the World Championship. So,
yeah.
But there's no doubt he came into the race, and as Rob said, you know, he came into the race believing he was going to win it on Sunday. I mean, after that pace he had, he was, you could see the confidence in him after the sprint. You know, Aleix is quite an emotional character, but he was very calm, and that was the confidence that he had in the pace that he had. But it just all went wrong in the race. So yeah, it's going to be a tough one to swallow, that Grand Prix performance for Aleix and Aprilia. Whereas the other Aprilia guys, yeah, they know they've got to do better. But I mean, Aleix is showing what the bike can do, a bit like Binder on the KTM. You know, the others have got to get up there with the lead rider, haven't they?
True. And as you said about riders adapting to machinery, there's one rider, when I've looked through their weekend results, it hasn't been what I've expected, and it's Marco Bezzecchi on the GP23. So he finished the sprint in 11th. And then yesterday he said that he kind of felt that he fixed something in warm-up with position. That seems to be his issue. You know, he feels like the bike's not really turning as much. But in the Grand Prix, he finished 14th, and he was 19 seconds off, you know, the top Ducati in Pecco Bagnaia. It's been a difficult start for Marco Bezzecchi this year, Rob. And especially with Fabio Di Gianantonio coming in and looking very strong. It's a big season for Bezzecchi, especially after he turned down the Pramac ride. So, you know, what will he need to do, do you think, to reset going into Portimao?
I think Qatar hasn't been his best circuit. He was, you know, he had a tough round there last season. I think for Bezzecchi, it's a case of just forgetting round one. And you can't really forget preseason because he struggled throughout. And a lot was made from the 22 bike to the 23, there potentially being like a rider or a riding adjustment that needs to be made by the rider. And Bezzecchi doesn't seem to have made that switch. And I think because Di Gianantonio has made it look so easy, and has just come into that team and hit the ground running, I think it's probably surprised Bezzecchi in a way. And obviously Mark is doing great things. And obviously Alex was up there as well,
yep,
on the 23 Gresini. So I think Bezzecchi was on the year-old bike a long, long way off. That will be the most worrying thing. It's maybe not the what he needs to improve, because I think he'll get there. He's obviously got the talent. When he was at his best last season, he not only won, but he dominated the races he won. And was pretty much untouchable. So we know Bezzecchi will turn it around, but it is a big year because, you know, factory rides are going to be given and they're going to be given out quite early. So I think for Bezzecchi, it's a case of just refinding what he had last year, getting comfortable with that bike. But obviously he was the only Ducati, aside from Morbidelli, who obviously went into round one on a completely different spectrum, yeah, because of the
pre-season.
It was
like a test session pretty much for him. Well, pre-season testing, you know, he did finish okay. Morbidelli, I think he finished the sprint in 20th. He was 23 seconds off, but then in the Grand Prix, he was 18th. He was 24 seconds off. So he's just trying to build as much, you know, confidence he can, adapting from Yamaha to Ducati. And yeah, like you said with Bezzecchi, it'll take time, but you know, when you look at the other GP23s, you know, Mark's fourth, Alex is in sixth, and Di Gianantonio's in seventh. So they're kind of all in that same window with each other. And yeah, it's definitely been surprising. I didn't expect it from Bezzecchi, but you know, I reckon come Portimao, he will be fine. I think it's maybe just something that needs to click with his riding style, but I think he will get there. I think we've pretty much covered everything with MotoGP. I want to talk about Moto 2 and 3, because Moto 2 often gets a bit of criticism, I think, you know, especially over the past few years with the tires. When the Dunlops were about, the races were kind of set in stone, maybe five laps in, you know, it was no one could really overtake because they had no grip. But Pete, we seen the complete opposite yesterday with the Pirellis. It was chaos in terms of management. You know, poor Aaron Canet, 15 times he's finished second place in Moto 2. He got pole position, looked strong in practice. It was his chance to win, but clearly not, as these tyres had caught a lot of riders out, so they did.
That's right, yeah. He struggled a bit on the start, didn't he? And he thought, oh, here we go. And then he just charged through the field, took the lead, and it was like, well, here it is. This is today's the day, or tonight's the night, wasn't it? And then, what's going on now? I think there was the medium tyre, wasn't it, that pretty much all of the front runners chose, which you would think would be the safest choice. But the soft turned out to be the one, didn't it, that you needed, yeah, on the rear. And we just saw them, as you say, just the lap times, the variation in lap times, the fluctuation. But as you quite rightly say, John, you know, Moto 2 has been a bit boring, isn't it? Let's be honest, some of the races in recent years, and it was definitely unpredictable. I mean, it's a nightmare for the teams and riders, isn't it? That's the one thing to say. But, I mean, it is the first race for Pirelli. It's bound to happen. They'd literally never done a race on these tyres before. So there was always going to be some sort of upset or surprises and learning curve and everything else. So it's, but, you know, it keeps it unpredictable. And let's see. But, you couldn't help but feel sorry for, well, I mean, Canet, you saw Tony Arbolino, you know, looked furious after the race, didn't he? Aldeguer was never in it. You know, the teammate to Alonso who won the race and obviously the pre-season favourite. It really shook things up, didn't it? And it's going to have, I think, more people keeping their eye on Moto 2 this year. If this is, you know, this kind of unpredictability and this big swing in lap times, I mean, that's...
it was incredible.
To literally, for one lap to another, have pace changing that much. I mean, it's been a long time since I can remember that happening.
It was pure chaos, and I think it's great for the fans and everyone watching. You know, it's not, like you said, it's not great for the teams and the riders. They want to fix and get this sorted, but yeah, as you said, Alonso Lopez wins on the Bosque Oscuro, and I suppose the biggest surprise was Barry Baltus. I mean, no one probably had that down for a podium, and yeah, Sergio Garcia in third as well on a Bosque Oscuro chassis. But going back to Barry Baltus, you know, yesterday, it was 21 years since Barry Sheen passed away, and he uses the number 7, and from what I've been told, his father named him after Barry Sheen, and for him to get his first Grand Prix podium on that day, I mean, Rob, it's pretty incredible for someone like that to come out of nowhere, really, and just to, he could have won the race.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's flashed some ability before, but it's not, we've never seen him consistently running anywhere near the top like that. And obviously, you know, given the day, you know, after the years after Barry Sheen and him being named after Barry Sheen, it's an incredible result. And like you said, he could have won the race. We've seen Alonso Lopez be inconsistent, but when he's been really fast, be able to win in Moto2 and be right up there. So that wasn't necessarily a surprise. But I think what was great about Moto2 yesterday is everything that it's not been the last 2 years, it was. Chaos,
yeah.
Unpredictability, surprises. Barry Baltus will be very, very happy with that. And we've seen some newer, fresher names yesterday come to the front of the field, which is great. At the same time, the names we expect, like Aldeguer, you know, you could see he was very, yeah, very frustrated after the race, sort of hitting the tank of his bike. So there's a lot of like thinking, and a lot of riders will be unhappy given the expectation they had. But for Barry Baltus, it's a case of great first result in round one. Where do we go from here? Will he be able to maintain that? Or was it sort of a flash in the pan, which we hope it won't be?
It's just like you say, we don't know, because the next round in Portimao could be completely different with the tyres. And I suppose it helps that they've tested around Portimao, which is a good thing as well. But when you look at the podium, you know, you have Sergio Garcia, who, as you mentioned, Pete, most people went for the medium tyre. He went for the softer tyre. And I think he was, at one point in the race, I think the first few laps, I watched it back this morning, he was like 15th or 16th. And then he just came out of nowhere. And you could see, you know, he caught up to his teammate Ayaguro, who's also on the Bosque Scuro, and he just rode through him. And I think people like Garcia, when they're in their second year of Moto2, and he's, especially because he's changed machinery to the Bosque Scuro, which looks to me, for me, for the first time in a long time, it's the bike to be on, because obviously we get certain races, especially on the Dunlops, whenever it was, say, hotter conditions for the Bosque Scuro, it would just dominate. You know, we'd seen Aldeguer completely disappear. Lopez had done it before as well. Moto2 is in a good place, I think. And you could arguably say, Pete, that it's actually preparing these riders better for MotoGP with tyre management now, because they're having to be so cautious.
Yeah, you know what, John? It sort of reminds me of the first Moto2 season, like back in 2010, when, you know, you had all these new chassis manufacturers coming out, and one week one chassis would do well, the next another. Yeah. Obviously, there's not that many chassis manufacturers now, but we could still see it with the riders, as you guys were pointing out, the names on the podium, you know, Baltus and Garcia, those guys. Okay, Alonso's been up there before, but that maybe we're in for that kind of season where we get a whole load of different guys up there each weekend, and it's going to be whoever can sort of manage the tyres, as you say, even on their bad days. You know, maybe top six, you know, that those sort of finishes, whoever can consistently be in the top six will be up there at the end of the championship, and everyone's going to sort of yo-yo up and down all the way along between there, along the season. So, yeah, I mean, it's a big shake-up for Moto2, but I think it's what it needed. And, yeah, I think it's, as we've said, people are going to be glued to it, watching it to see what happens next. But no doubt for the teams and riders, they're going to be going through the data, you know, looking now, trying to understand, how do we use these new tyres? How do we use these, you know, get the most from them? How do we get them to last a Grand Prix distance? And I think we're in for some interesting opening rounds.
Definitely. And then touching on Moto3, Rob, obviously, of course, they're using Pirelli as well. And we've seen a few big crashes in Moto3. Thankfully, the riders are all okay from the incidents, but, you know, the title favourite essentially came out on top. You know, David Alonso, another last lap, just sensational lap that he put together. He started the last lap in fifth, and he just appears, and he's right on the back, and then he wins. He just overtakes. You know, Danny Holgado said that in his after, well, he said to Simon Crafer that he couldn't believe how hard that Alonso had braked for the last corner, and he was braking hard. And yeah, I think it shows why he's the favourite for many.
I think, unlike Moto2, we sort of saw the two title favourites in Moto3 finish first and second. But that wasn't to say that, again, there was plenty of surprises and new names at the front. But I think for Alonso, he's very talented rider, but he's also shown a consistent ability in the races to move forward and be there or thereabouts at the end. It's a unique ability he sort of has. It's something that we've seen from Acosta before, something we see from Marc Marquez, Brad Binder in MotoGP, that ability to, whatever's gone on previously in the weekend or even early on in the race, they build and get strong as the race goes on. And, you know, to go from fifth to first on the last lap is hard for any rider, and it's hard in any category. So to do that was very, very impressive. I thought it was a brilliant performance and a great race. I mean, Moto3 is chaos at the best of times.
Oh, yeah.
And 100%. It's going to be another crazy year, I think.
Yeah, every year I seem to think it can't get any worse, can it? Not worse, but it's like it can't get any more crazy, and it just does. I think also I'll give a shout out to Ivan Ortola. Now, he was unlucky. Rueda had crashed at turn one, took him out, but he remounted and was at the back. He ended up finishing in ninth place. And I think he was a real strong, you know, many people were tipping him for a title charge this year. For him to get a ninth place after being essentially last, after getting knocked off, really impressive. And I think that we'll see those riders, Alonso, Ortola, Holgado. I think they're going to be the main three that we're going to have in this title fight. But as you mentioned, so many new names. And Tao Furusato as well on the Honda Team Asia bike. Incredible to see him progress through the years that he's had in Moto3 and to be fighting at the front. Because, Pete, we touched on it, I think, off camera last week. Maybe the Moto3, you know, they've had a big shake-up in terms of development, and the Honda didn't really look like it was anywhere near the KTM, but it showed in the race that, you know, it is still a competitive bike.
Yeah, it was a great ride by Furusato, wasn't it? And in front of the HRC president, I think, as well. So that's always good timing, isn't it? And he put the Honda up there against the KTMs of various brands, shall we say, but they're all KTMs, aren't they? And good performance from him, because really, I think going into the season, as you say, Jordan, people weren't expecting much from the Honda. And I think there had been maybe a few new parts, last-minute parts, after the testing to try and sort of get them up to speed and sort of, get back on terms. And, he showed what was possible, but very much the exception at the moment. But, you know, the other Honda guys, they know that bike can go on the podium. I mean, there's no reason why not when you see what Furusato did. And, as you say, Rueda, I think he's some people are tipping him for the title as well. Impressive guy. But, just went wrong early on. And Ortola was the innocent victim there as well, wasn't he? But, let's see. It's going to be a long season. You know, these guys in Moto3, everyone's going to make mistakes during the year. So let's see who keeps it together all the way through. But Alonso's performance, he was tipped, wasn't he, by I think most of the MotoGP riders when they were asked, weren't they, for their preseason title favourite. And certainly Marc Marquez has always been sort of banging the drum about how good Alonso is. So, I think not shocked to see him up there, but the way he did it was very impressive. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe when Holgado watches it back, he might wish he went a little bit tighter into the final turn. But, maybe Alonso would still have found a way by.
Probably. And I think it's great for MotoGP to have someone, a South American, Colombian, be there in the sport. You know, we have had South American riders in the past, but I think that's going to open up a whole new market for them. And it's great to see such a level-headed, cool guy as well. He's just, he's a great rider. And I can't wait to see what he can do in the future. If he moves on to Moto2, I think he'll be a great rider. But guys, I think that pretty much covers it. We've talked plenty. MotoGP is back and it's great, and I hope that you've enjoyed listening. Make sure to subscribe to wherever you listen to your podcasts, and make sure to follow, subscribe. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe to our channel, like the video, and we'll have plenty more content throughout the year. Other than that, it's pretty much, we'll see you next time, and hope you enjoyed the show.